Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes. Is that a good thing to have someone like Taylor Swift there?
Power in one sphere does not necessarily translate into power in another. Her role is to be a unifying figure.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find it on the ABC Listen app.
From Wandjeri Country, I'm Luke Sidham-Dunton, and today on The Breakfast Wrap, the Nationals have done it. The party has officially dumped its support for net zero emissions by 2050. So what does that mean for the coalition?
Well, this is about policy rather than necessarily politics within the coalition.
This is a huge test for Susan Lee's leadership.
Does this decision make it more difficult for the Liberal Party to remain committed to net zero?
You'll get the answer from the Liberals, and you'll also hear from the leader of the Nationals. Then, imagine if you suffered a power outage every single week. That's what thousands of Indigenous homes are dealing with. We'll try and find out why that's happening. And then we'll head overseas, because Donald Trump is threatening Africa's most populous country, Nigeria.
He's also warned that the US would go in, quote, with guns a-blazing.
So what does that really mean, and what's actually happening in Nigeria? From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, the Liberal Party is still in the process of reviewing its policy platform following its disastrous loss at the federal election. But that hasn't stopped its coalition partner, the Nationals, from announcing a pretty major policy shift. The party has scrapped its commitment to reach net zero emissions by 2050, but it says it still wants to reduce emissions. Today you're going to hear from both coalition partners. So we'll start with the ones making the news. David Littleproud is the leader of the Nationals and the Shadow Minister for Agriculture. He came on Radio National Breakfast, and Sally Sara interrogated the decision.
The party committed to net zero in 2021. What's changed?
Well, the lived experience of the costs of Australians' energy bills continue to going up, the job losses and the future job losses even of in the last week of Tomago, whereby we still have a responsibility to continue to reduce emissions, and we want to live up to that. But we believe there's a cheaper, better, fairer way to do that, living up to international commitments, but putting at the fore of that affordable energy for Australians and for industry, looking at adaptation, investing back into the environment around adaptation of our climate and environment, and making sure that we keep pace with the rest of the world, not get ahead of it too far. And that's why when you're about 1.1% of total emissions, what we want to say is, well, we shouldn't let ourselves get away from that percentage, and we should peg ourselves to what the rest of the world is, not become a laggard, but not streak ahead and make sure that we have a consistent policy that's not going to cost Australians, which at this the cost of net zero by 2050 will be $9 trillion. That will put things like Medicare and NDIS at risk, when we can still live up to our international commitments and calmly reduce emissions in a sensible way. And that is the policy that we have come up with yesterday as a result of the lived experience over the last 4 years.
You're talking about Australia contributing 1% when it comes to emissions. We know that Australia's emissions per capita are around three times the global average. Does Australia need to do more heavy lifting?
No, I think we should do our fair share, particularly when there's an energy affordability issue for Australians at the moment, not just in industry, but for households. There's Australians tonight that will not have dinner, that can't afford to put dinner on the table. In an energy-rich country such as Australia, the fact that we've got ourselves into this predicament is time to pivot. And when you see what the rest of the world is doing, you're seeing not just in terms of achievements of goals, but also their aspirational targets into the future. Why wouldn't we make sure that we keep pace with them rather than streak ahead more than...
But you're out of step with the Business Council of Australia and the National Farmers Federation. They count the dollars pretty carefully. Why is your position so different?
Well, with all due respect, the Business Council of Australia, I'd hardly take any gratuitous advice from. They get to pass it on. They get to pass it on to you. Big business can sign up to this because you know who pays? It's you. It's when you go to the checkout. It's when you go to buy or to build a home.
But they're obviously seeing market opportunities there as well in the renewable space as well. They don't want job losses.
No, and nor do I, but let me tell you that renewables is not the only way to have and to create jobs. You need reliable, affordable energy. Just ask the people at Tomago. Where was the BCA sitting at the front door of Tomago asking them about how and why they're in trouble? They're in trouble because they don't have affordable energy. And I'm not saying we should run away from our commitments. We should actually live up to reducing emissions. That's a good thing. Make no mistake, I believe man has made a contribution to climate and the
change. But not having a target.
What we do, we're pegging ourselves to what the rest of the world does. The first principle is we want to reduce emissions. The second principle is we've got to do it in an affordable way. And that's what we've said is we're not walking away from reductions in emissions, but we believe that there is a cheaper, better, fairer way to do it.
What does all this mean for the cohesion of the coalition?
Well, this is about policy rather than necessarily politics within the coalition. After the election, we made it very clear that we were going to review our policy and on net zero. The Liberal Party was undertaking the same. It's been a process we've been very public about. We started in June with Page Research Institute giving us some support around that. And so we got to a juncture where that's complete. And now what we'll do is we'll work when the Liberal Party gets to their position in a constructive way with a process that both Susan Lee and I both agree on, is that we should get our two positions, bring them together and work through them to work through a coalition policy. I respect their sovereignty to become to their position as they've respected the National Party in our process to be able to achieve it as
and
well.
What's the blunt sort of political reality here? If the Liberals come up that their policy is to stick with net zero to 2050, can the coalition stay together when you have two completely different positions on that issue?
Well, those are discussions we'll have if it arises. I don't want to deal in hypotheticals. What we want to do is, from what I've experienced over the last couple of months and seeing the work within the coalition on much of the energy policy, I don't think there's a lot of difference in terms of what we're trying to achieve here. So I think we come to this when the Liberal Party get to their position with good faith and the knowledge that there are a lot more similarities than there are differences.
Nationals leader David Littleproud there, speaking with Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. Well, as promised, the other side of the coalition coin. Dan Tehan is the Shadow Minister for Energy and Emissions Reduction. He joined Sally immediately after Mr. Littleproud, and he was asked if this move was tightening the screws on the Liberal Party.
Does this decision by the Nationals, does it make it more difficult for the Liberal Party to remain committed to net zero?
Well, we always knew that the National Party had a process that they had put in place. We've obviously got a separate process. We had a very constructive meeting on Friday amongst Liberal Party MPs. And once again, it was very clear that we agree on the majority of things. Now, we'll continue to also work with the National Party as we have. There is a hell of a lot that we have in that is similar, hell of a lot that is similar. And so we'll continue that process. I look forward to having further discussions on the fine detail of what they've decided over the weekend, and we'll do that hopefully this week, and then continue our methodical process as well.
What's the timeframe for your review process now for the Libs?
Well, I've always said, you know, roughly 6 to 9 months. And so I want to make sure that the number one thing that we're all focused on is getting the policy right. This is critically important for Australia's future. So setting some sort of arbitrary deadline has never been what this is about. What we want to do is make sure that we get it right. And we've got to get it right in understanding, okay, what is it that we need to do to make affordable energy our number one priority, but at the same time be doing our bit when it comes to reducing emissions. And we're working through that methodically. We've been doing it not only as a Liberal Party, but also jointly with the National Party, very constructively, I might add, and we'll continue to do that. And look, as soon as we're ready, then we'll obviously announce our policy. But the most important thing is to get it right.
Would it be realistic to expect that you might have the results from that before Parliament rises at the end of the year?
Look, in a perfect world, it would be great to have it done by Christmas. But as I've said, it's the most important thing is to get it right. And it's a real challenge, energy policy. It underpins everything that's essential to our economy. And we've got to be able to get back to that focus on affordability first. That has to be an absolute key. And then we've also got to make sure we're doing our bit when it comes to emissions reduction. And how you balance those two and thread that needle is obviously going to be absolutely key as to how we land our policy.
As you're saying, in your view, it's very important to be careful and take time to get it right. Have the Nats gone too quickly here, in your view?
No, I think the National Party have had their process. They've had their timelines. Obviously, they had their federal convention over the weekend. They also wanted to make sure that following that, as I understand it, they had a clear position as a party. And look, I respect that. They've got their process and they've stuck to their process, because all the way through this, we've met every time Parliament has sat together, the Liberal Party and the National Party, on our working committee, and we've had very respectful, very good conversations. None of that information has found its way out into the media. So it's been a process where I think we've paid each other a lot of respect, and so I look forward to continue to working along those lines.
Dan Tandare, the Shadow Minister for Energy and Emissions Reduction. I'm sure there'll be plenty more to discuss on that story right throughout the week. Well, let's jump overseas for just a moment and turn to a country that we don't often cover, Nigeria. It's made global headlines after the US president claimed he'd ordered the Pentagon to prepare for potential military action there if Nigeria fails to crack down on the killing of Christians. He's also warned that the US would go in, quote, guns a-blazing, to wipe out the Islamic terrorists committing these horrible atrocities. Nigeria's president, Bola Ahmed Tinubu, has rejected Mr. Trump's claims, saying that the country protects citizens of all faiths and celebrates its religious diversity. Our international producer, Anne Barker, sought out Namdi Obasi from the International Crisis Group, based in Abuja, the Nigerian capital. He shared what the reaction has been on the ground.
The official reaction has again been that the killings in Nigeria are misread and exaggerated and do not call for the kinds of reaction that the United States government has pronounced. But then this evening, we also heard that the presidency here is planning for a meeting between President Bola Tinubu and President Donald Trump. But there's no indication of when or where that meeting would hold. Otherwise, there's also be a great deal of pushback against U.S. unilateral intervention in Nigeria. Some people think it would be counterproductive. It would exacerbate, you know, rather than help in resolving the problems in Nigeria.
What's the reality of the violence in Nigeria when it comes to violence between Christians and Muslims?
Well, let me say right away that it's a lot more complex than the United States government is being led to believe. Nigeria is battling several complex security challenges resulting from religious extremism, from banditry, resource competitions exacerbated by climate change, communal disputes, and so on and so forth. And these challenges have resulted in the killings of both Christians and Muslims by a variety of groups, some Islamist groups, some bandit groups, some other armed militia groups. So basically, both Christians and Muslims have been victims. And the narrative that seeks to frame the situation largely as a mass slaughter of Christians grossly misrepresents the reality.
Is there anger from any people in Nigeria or from the official level to these latest comments from Donald Trump?
Yes, there is, depending on who you are speaking with. I've had people saying, well, you know, there have also been mass shootings in churches in the U.S. The U.S. has its own problems and is overstepping the bounds of respect between countries and trying to carry out a unilateral operation in Nigeria. There has been a call for the severance of diplomatic relations with the U.S., you know, because of this action or statements that are seen as very disrespectful of Nigeria. There's also the view that Nigeria needs more help and more support and maybe more pressure from the international community to act, you know, rather than, you know, being isolated and being cut off from both economic and military aid. I think on the other hand, there are also people who are quietly, you know, happy that the government is being pushed to do something better. I mean, most Nigerians always thought that the government could do better in, you know, reining in the armed groups and ending the violence and sanctioning perpetrators. So to that extent, there are people who are quietly happy that some pressure is being brought to bear on the government, you know, to do things a little with a little sense of urgency.
Nnamdi Obasi is from the International Crisis Group based in Abuja, the Nigerian capital, who's discussing the potential threat from Donald Trump to carry out military action there. Have you ever had an hours-long power disconnection to your home? What about during a heatwave? Well, according to a new Landmark report, about 65,000 First Nations households, which have prepaid supply arrangements, are being disconnected up to 59 times per year. The interruptions affect food security, as well as the health and well-being of customers. And what's more, is that there's little room to move or change how electricity is provided to these households and the broader communities. The co-author of this unique report into prepaid power is Lauren Mello. She's the Clean Energy Program Director at Original Power, and she explained to Sally just what surprised her in the findings.
Despite prepayment being an expanding supply arrangement for many First Nations communities, including most recently into South Australia, we've never had a comprehensive look at how the experience of accessing electricity in this very precarious way is experienced by First Nations communities and energy customers. This report has relied on unprecedented access to customer energy use data. We've had four of the five retailers using prepayment in Australia collaborate, which has been really important to get that picture of how often disconnections are happening. And then from the household perspective, we've spoken to hundreds of households across the north of Australia and asked them what's happening inside the home when you're without power for this amount of time. And the results are alarming. You will have seen many of the standout findings in that report, which say that some of these families are going without power in temperatures soaring above 40 degrees for days at a time. So certainly the impact of extreme heat and the flow-on implications that has for people's health, well-being, the productivity of those communities has just been really stark. And so what it's been able to do is give us a pathway forward to seek reform on prepayment with the federal government, with state and territory governments, and with retailers to really bring this form of supply arrangement into alignment with other consumer protections that we have in the energy market more generally.
So, Lauren, what does this prepayment system look like in an individual household? How does it work?
Most Australians would be unfamiliar with prepayment. What it looks like is similar to a prepaid mobile phone, where a customer needs to go down to the local store, need to purchase some credit, usually in the form of a voucher or topping up a card. They'll come home, enter that into their meter, press go, and the home is energised for that period of time. As soon as that credit runs out, the home is automatically without power and they lose all the basic functions of a healthy home, including, most importantly, refrigeration and cooling.
And is there any warning? How do you know when it's going to run out?
No, and that's one of the big issues is the low functionality of this to actually inform a customer of how much credit they have left, when they're about to run out. So we're actually seeing that quite a number of these disconnections could be avoided simply by having some sort of warning system. What we're seeing at the moment is customers who are very concerned about their energy use, they're already self-rationing because they can't afford to keep the credit rolling for that entire fortnight. They're regularly going outside the home, opening their switchboard meter, pressing a button and having a look how much power they've got left. So you imagine the disruption to daily life, needing to check whether you've chewed through $20 or $30 worth of power a day. That's how people are staying informed. So one of our recommendations is there are some really basic functional improvements to prepayment to actually let customers know how they're going with that credit, warning systems, in-house displays. There are some really low-hanging fruit where retailers, if they were motivated to do more for their prepayment customers, could actually help avoid a lot of those disconnections. And it does contribute to overcrowding. We heard from many families who said, when we run out of power on an extremely hot day, and these are really hot box, poorly designed homes that we're talking about in these remote communities, whole families are moving next door and contributing to that overcrowding. And what the report has found is that level of disruption and dislocation across community households is contributing to things like the really high rates of rheumatic heart disease that we're seeing. Diseases that are based on overcrowding and that should be avoidable are being contributed to because people don't have secure energy in their homes.
And that's Lauren Mello, the Clean Energy Program Director at Original Power, speaking to Sally on Radio National Breakfast. But let's end with some food for thought. How much Australian music do you listen to? Would it surprise you to know that less than 10% of music streamed by Australians comes from Australian artists? Sure, we've got plenty of artists pumping out tunes, but in the age of algorithms, many musicians are actually struggling to cut through. Music Australia has teamed up with a few artists to launch the Ozify Your Algo campaign, and the chair of the Live Music Business Council of Australia, Howard Adams, came on and explained just how it works.
It is a reaction to the fact that the algorithms that are used to select music on streaming services are heavily biased against Australian emerging artists. The reason for that is, of course, that algorithms are notoriously safe. They're first and foremost there to try and keep you listening to the streaming platform. And so what they will do is they'll suggest music that's very similar to the music that you've listened to or music that you've previously liked, and maybe they'll suggest something new. But if you don't immediately engage with it, they won't do that again. So what this campaign seeks to do is to disrupt the algorithm. And if you go to the ozify.com website, you'll find a newly curated playlist each day, which you can download onto your phone, into your Spotify account, and engage with, listen to it, like it, share it, and eventually the algorithm will get the message, if enough of us do this, that that music is trending. And what that does for Aussie artists, it means that, well, A, they get streamed more, so they make a little bit more money, but also it means that they'll end up on playlists and they'll be heard by more and more people.
It's an incredibly simple idea in a very complex environment. What do we know about what happens with these algorithms? If you get something of an economy of scale that you get enough kind of weight there, does it then kind of click artists and their music into wider distribution?
Yeah, essentially that's right. It'll look for songs that people are following, trending, liking, and it will then take a risk that it can suggest those songs to more and more people. And eventually, what started off as a game becomes a reality and it snowballs. That's how things go viral, as it were. So what we are doing, what we in the music community are doing, is trying to sort of teach the algorithm that there is a market out there for Australian music, and it can service it, and it can actually benefit Spotify in the end. I mean, if you think about this, if you've got young children, you'll hear the music around the house. A lot of it is American hip-hop music. Mm. Even older people that I speak to are stuck in a vortex because they don't have Triple J anymore to help them find new music. They want new music. They want to go to gigs, but they can't because they don't really know where to start. So if we all make a promise to ourselves that we'll do this, if you just go to the ozify.com.au website, search Ozify in your search engine. So that's the call to arms. If you care about Australian music, this is Australian Month, Australian Music Month. Just do this every day and it will make a difference and it will make your life more interesting.
And that's something we certainly try and do every day right here. That sounds like a pretty good way to do it when you need something else to listen to. You were just hearing from the chair of the Live Music Business Council of Australia, Howard Adams, talking about that Ozify Your Algo campaign. And that is it for the Breakfast Wrap for today. Every interview was presented by Sally Sara, produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team, and the Breakfast Wrap was produced by Josie Scott. You can catch Radio National Breakfast every morning at 5:30 a.m. on the wireless or the ABC Listen app, and then later on, the Brekkie Wrap with me, Luke Sidham-Dunton. We'll catch you tomorrow. Same time, same place.